Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The usual two guests today. First, the economist Max Sawicki will look at Trump's budget. And then Financial Times columnist Edward Luce will examine the crisis of the American class system. Every February, the president presents a budget for the U.S. government that is more a wish list than anything else, since Congress does most of the fiscal work. More than a century ago, the German sociologist Rudolf Goldscheid said, "A government's budget is the skeleton of the state stripped of all misleading ideologies." I first deployed this quote analyzing Bill Clinton's budgets, which were presented with a lot of high-flown rhetoric about investing in people, but in close examination offered little of the sort. Today's problems are rather different. Last week, Trump presented what he, or the people who think and write for him, called an American budget. It is a vicious document proposing all sorts of cuts to the humane things government does, and an expansion of the violent things it does, in particular harassing and deporting immigrants and building up the military, which Trump regularly describes as depleted. Max Sawicki is an economist who has worked at the Economic Policy Institute and the Government Accountability Office. Now that he's retired from government work, he can speak freely. Here's Max Sawicki to tell us what's in Trump's budget. Max, Trump unveiled an American budget, as he, I believe they're calling it, the other day. I guess it's dead on arrival in Congress, but what do you make of what the numbers in the budget say about the priorities of this dreadful administration?
A year ago, I wrote a piece on Trump's first budget, which was called Trump Trolls the Welfare State. I think we're getting more of that. They, I think, deliberately choose victims on the logic that it will energize the most deplorable components of their base. Now, in this case, this year, some of the victims are quite serious. The biggest sore thumb in this is the proposed cuts to what used to be called food stamps, what's now called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And everybody's heard about this, where they make an analogy to the Blue Apron company, where instead of giving people cash to buy groceries, they're going to give them a box of food, which they're calling a harvest box.
Now, that's pretty weird because, you know, the conservatives usually dislike the nanny state and prefer market relations. Giving people money to buy the food that they choose, you would think, aside from the fact that it comes from the government, would be a more market-friendly thing than choosing the menu and delivering it to them. I mean, what do you make of it?
Well, it's, you know, their usual hypocrisy. Somebody made the useful point that they want to restrict choices when it comes to groceries, but in the case of the Consumer Financial Protection Board, they want to expand choice when it comes to dodgy financial services like payday lending. So it's what we've come to expect, which is just a constant elevated level of hypocrisy in all of their dealings with the public.
Food stamps used to be safe because agricultural state congresspeople liked them. Has that changed?
It appears to have. There used to be this sort of legendary triumph of log rolling between the rural states typified by the leadership of Senator Dole and the more liberal standpoint in this, which was typified by George McGovern. And that seems to have eroded over the decades. So now we have somebody like Paul Ryan from Wisconsin calling for turning food stamps into a block grant, which would go much further than the Trump budget proposal and really wreck it in the same way that they wrecked the aid for families with dependent children under Bill Clinton's infamous welfare reform in 1996.
What about these block grants? It's a favorite of conservatives. Why do they prefer those, and what's sinister about them?
The block grant for conservatives is transitional to having no program at all. The way the block grant is proposed only as a substitute for some other program, which typically has a match. So what you get with block grants are two things. You get elimination of the matching feature, which removes the incentive for state or local governments to supply their own funds. And secondly, you get a consolidation of smaller programs, which typically have more active advocates in Washington. When you merge a bunch of small programs, each of which are energetically supported when you consolidate the money, you don't add money, actually. When you consolidate the money and you make the purposes of the program much more general and vague, then you basically kill the diverse political support for the prior programs. In the past, what started under Reagan was they would put a sweetener in for state and local government officials in the form of somewhat higher funding. And the way it was scheduled to decrease over time. So strategically, what they achieved at the end of the day was absolute cuts in discretionary spending for these programs. So the block grant thing is basically a transition to reducing and eventually eliminating federal funding altogether. They would never propose a new block grant out of the blue that didn't replace some other group of programs.
Yeah, and the point is that the amount of the block grant will decline over time, right? So it's kind of a bait and switch.
Right. It's hardwired into the process.
Medicaid. What are they looking to do with Medicaid?
Well, again, with the Trump budget, one has to keep in mind, I think, that it's a two-tiered political system here. You have the White House, which typically doesn't sweat details about anything except maybe immigration. And you have Congress, which is actually doing, Republican Congress, which is doing all the heavy lifting. The Trump budget has been described as a vision statement, which is, I think, a sort of benign turn of phrase, but basically
more like a nightmare.
It's a series of hit jobs. It's not going to be whatever Congress, the Republican Congress, decides to do. It's a way to rev up their base and actually raise trial balloons for truly horrible proposals, which include eliminating altogether a flock of small programs and putting major hits on some of the big ones, such as food stamps.
So Medicaid, what are they planning to do with that?
They're proposing to turn it into a kind of hybrid block grant with what's called the per capita caps. And the way this gets into can get pretty arcane, but basically they're going to match spending as they do now in Medicaid, but only up to set amounts for different kinds of Medicaid recipients. And the way the caps are designed, as with block grants, they're designed to rise more slowly over time than healthcare costs are projected to rise. So in the longer term, once again, contrary to Trump's campaign promises, the end result would be significant cuts in Medicaid.
So this budget has been pronounced dead on arrival, as presidential budgets usually are, because Congress is the body that really does all this work. Is this deader than usual, or does this have some signs of life in it?
It is deader than usual. As I said a second ago, it's a Republican Congress that's really doing the heavy lifting. The president's budget is really put forward as a provocation rather more than a serious proposal. The Congress will do the detail work, and they'll give Trump something to sign. He can claim a great triumph by the virtue of having something signed. It seems like the only domestic policies the administration's really, the White House is really interested in, pertain to immigration.
And what about this infrastructure scheme? Trump made a lot of noise during the campaign about it. He's been talking about it ever since. Is there any there?
Well, that's lighter than air than all of the rest of this. What they're proposing to do on one hand is provide some new money under a sign that says infrastructure plan. And meanwhile, they're cutting funding for the cabinet departments that do most infrastructure funding in the rest of the budget, namely the Department of Transportation and to a lesser extent some other departments. So there's actually very little new money, actual dollars, federal dollars. What you have are half-baked devices to try to stimulate more spending by state and local governments and by private parties through an array of subsidies, which are pretty unlikely to have any net effect on overall infrastructure spending.
So this is basically encouraging the development of toll roads, privately owned toll roads. Is that what they've got in mind?
Well, I think they would like to stimulate more of those. Yeah, that's part of what would, in theory, reduce the overall cost of this. But to me, the salient element in this is there's very little new money when you net out the cuts in the rest of the budget. And that's really what cuts the cake, or doesn't it? If you don't put money out there, you're not going to provoke any additional activity than what would have happened otherwise. That's me the nub of it.
I'm speaking with the economist Max Sawicki. But the military, which of course Trump likes to refer to as our depleted military, I don't know what planet he's been living on, but our depleted military, they're getting blank checks, right?
Well, they're getting increases. There are caps which have been lifted, and one of the interesting things, of course, they lifted the cap for non-defense as well, and thereby outraging, if not making obsolete, the House Freedom Caucus, which is not a bad thing in and of itself. What matters more, I think, than the fact that they lifted the caps to some limited extent is that they have the principle now that you can lift the caps. So they're not really caps. They can just decide one year after another how much more they're going to spend. One thing that hasn't really gotten as much notice is something that actually caused me to recall a column that Milton Friedman wrote once. He wrote something that had a headline, "The Taxes Call Deficits." And he made the point, which I think is valid, that as long as you're increasing spending, even if only marginally, you can't cut taxes. You can only reschedule taxes. As long as spending is going up, which it is, you're not cutting taxes. You're just changing the time that they will eventually have to be paid insofar as the government maintains any kind of constraint on borrowing.
Now, those caps you're talking about, that was something Obama agreed to, right, as some kind of
right version
of the grand bargain that the fiscally orthodox have always dreamed of, wasn't it?
Yes.
How'd they come to be, and what did they do to us, and what does it mean now that they've been lifted?
It doesn't mean that much in terms of the amount of money involved. What we've had as a result of the caps is another period of starvation of non-defense discretionary spending, which could have helped the economy and boosted employment. So the amount that they've been raised is not all that much. The principle that they can now go ahead and raise them at will may come to matter more in future budgets.
They seem to have stopped worrying about deficits, though, right? This is that going back to the Reagan years when deficits no longer mattered.
Well, I mean, as everybody's been saying, they never cared about deficits. They use them as a weapon to attack parts of the budget they don't like, and also to enact tax cuts, which, as I mentioned a second ago, are not really cuts from the standpoint of the long term, because when you're raising spending and you maintain some break on borrowing, you're going to pay for that eventually.
The fiscal effects of this kind of budgeting are interesting, because coming out of it, we had a big stimulus package after the Great Recession. That ran off after a year or two. And since then, we've been running a pretty tight fiscal policy. We're, 8-9 years into an expansion, and now we're going to inject a bunch of fiscal stimulus. Is there any kind of precedent for this policymaking?
Well, one thing that comes to mind is what has been very widely hailed as one of the worst fiscal policy decisions in history, namely the increase in deficit spending at the height of the Vietnam War. Now, on this one, there's a contrarian notion, which I think is worth a little consideration. The extent to which we could be said to be at full employment, meaning there's no slack in the labor market, people that would be willing to work if the work was available, I think tends to be exaggerated by a lot by many on the Democratic side, meaning I think there's more slack out there than is commonly thought. And that means that the stimulus implied by the budget that's coming down the pike, although it's badly, you wouldn't design it this way yourself if you wanted to do stimulus, because it's stacked towards the wealthy and it wouldn't be very efficient, the stimulus. But nevertheless, it is stimulus in its own way. And I think the extent to which it would have positive results tends to be discounted by people that are just determined to nail Trump on the dissonance between him whining about the national debt while increasing it all the time.
The deficit worry wards seem to have largely disappeared as a political force. Are they going to come back?
Yeah, I think they will. Because it's just too tempting to contrast Republican statements about debt with what they actually do. Even though the actual result in terms of stimulus, even now, might be marginally positive.
So are we going to see the Democrats once again become the party of fiscal orthodoxy and the Republicans are just spending like drunken sailors?
I think some of the Democrats just never stop doing that, and they're going to keep doing it. They don't have a different line. Even Bernie Sanders has been fairly cautious about talking about deficits in his own, and he's apparently the left wing of the possible right now. So the Democrats seem to still be in this box. They like to score the Republicans on being hypocritical and be a little brave about saying, well, we're not going to get hamstrung by deficit talk. But I think in the actual event, I think they still tend to be restrained in that way. And basically, they lose the debate to the Republicans every time, because the Republicans can talk fiscal responsibility, completely go against it in actual practice, and get away with it because their base is just rabidly loyal to whatever they do. And the Democrats are still conflicted by some dedication to logic and past rhetoric.
And what do you think the Republican Congress is going to do this budget? They're not going to adopt it in its present form, but what do you think will survive, or what delightful additions will they provide?
They'll have their own budget, and Trump will sign and pretend that it was his budget. I don't see them. I mean, they'll exploit the trial balloons that the administration, the White House, has sent up, such as for food stamps, for really mortally wounding the food stamp program. But I think they're mostly going their own way on this. As I mentioned before, the one issue where the administration is really intrusive as far as this goes is around the immigration questions about DACA and legal immigration and the wall. That's where they're really keyed up. And I think they've also figured out that being forward on racism is really the key to their political survival right now. The Republicans in Congress just sort of go along with it and humor them and try to soften the edge of this in some cases. But it's really kind of two separate movements at this point, the way I see it.
Finally, what do you expect the Democrats will do, or what can they do? Can they block some of the more odious parts of this, or can it roll right through Congress?
Well, there's a deal in Congress. The caps have been lifted on non-defense. The Democrats they get away with allowing the defense increase, and they're going to resist overt cuts to Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, and things will just roll forward, I think. I don't see them buying into overt cuts in the big social insurance program. There is a lot of Republican support for this per capita cap device in Medicaid. And so we might see that at least rolled out as a proposal. It's dubious that the Democrats would go for it. If they did, again, they'd basically be buying into a long-term major cut in the program. And I think that would deter most of them, if not all of them. So in the short term, I don't see huge damage from the deal in Congress, putting aside the immigration stuff, which is really horrible. But again, this is a process, and when the administration floats things that are currently unmentionable to a lot of members of Congress, it paves the way for them being legitimized in the not-too-distant future.
That was the economist Max Sawicki. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of Bach's Toccata No. 2 for keyboard, performed by Christian Jacotet. Next, Edward Luce. In a recent column for the Financial Times, Luce wrote of the crisis of the American class system. For years, we were said to have replaced our old aristocracy of birth with one based on merit. The perfect symbol of this was Bill Clinton and his attendance at the Renaissance weekends in Hilton Head, South Carolina. Those now seem like a relic of a more innocent time. The Bush years smashed that idol, though Barack Obama attempted something of a reprise. Now with Trump at the helm, it's really hard to sustain the illusion, and of course it was always was an illusion, that we are ruled by the best among us. Money and status were always the measures of merit, not intellect or virtue. But it was a pleasant fiction for a while. Luce's column called all those beliefs into question in a fashion unusual for an elite outlet like the FT. Besides his column for the Financial Times, Luce is the author of Time to Start Thinking, which he discussed in this show back in 2012, and most recently of The Retreat of Western Liberalism, published last year by Little Brown. Edward Luce. You opened the column in the Financial Times last week by recalling David Brooks's Bobos in Paradise and his argument that the old WASP elite had been replaced by a new meritocracy. Skills, not birth, were the ways to money and power now. How's that that analysis looking now?
He described it through the New York Times marriage announcements, wedding announcements page, where the style changed from, you know, mentioning which university and which relatives and which uncles and which ancestry the groom had. The bride was always mentioned very perfunctorily and only through ancestral placing, to a completely different kind of wedding announcement in the 1990s where and onwards, where it was really the educational and achievement bona fides of both partners that was stressed, highly inventively, looking like a sort of breathless resume, really, and that signaled a very strong change in values. I think that holds up. What I think doesn't hold up is the idea that the meritocracy, that we do actually live in a meritocratic society, because I think what we've seen deepen and entrench itself in the last, particularly the last 20 years, is what I would call a hereditary meritocracy that is able to, in the words of Richard Reeves of the Brookings Institution, really opportunity, hoard opportunities for its children, dream hoarders, he calls them, and make it in practice, if not deliberately, if not sort of intentionally or consciously, in practice, extremely difficult for people who aren't born with lots of social capital to move up the ladder and join the elites. And, you know, one good example would be the number of legacy places there are at the Ivy League universities. Another would be just how easy it is if you're from a privileged background to cram your children with tutorials and internships and all kinds of introductions and connections that is simply unavailable to other people. And the outcome of this is really a new class system, a different kind of one that's far more nervous of its position, that is educationally in a sort of permanent panic about its children, but which is nevertheless a deeply entrenched class.
Meritocracy was, of course, a word coined by, I believe, a British Labour politician who didn't approve of the concept. But it was supposed to be somewhat fluid. And what you're describing is something that has turned into a rather rigid, you know, as you say, hereditary kind of system. What happened?
Michael Young was the man who coined it, the book, famous book, The Rise of the Meritocracy in 1958, I believe. And it's been sort of taken unironically, not least by Tony Blair, since then, as a pine to the meritocracy, when, as you say, in fact, it was really a kind of comedy of manners, his book. And in the book, he predicts very precisely that by 2033, the meritocracy will cease to exist, the class system will be overthrown because its contradictions and the resentments it generates will lead to a backlash. Now, he might have been too optimistic. We're living in 2018. And I think there is a lot of disaffection and awareness about the shortcomings and, dare I say it, hypocrisy of meritocratic values that are manifesting themselves in disturbing ways, not least, I think, through Trumpianism. So the fate of meritocracy is, I think, really at the core of what's happening to American politics and other countries, Britain included, right now. I think that the outcome is uncertain. We shouldn't underestimate the strength, the power of self-belief, which is a key characteristic, the power of self-belief of our meritocratic elites, that everything they have earned. And that is sort of something that I mean, David Brooks, of course, many others, Michael Young in his original book, identified as a very defining characteristic. It's the belief, the zealous belief in your own merit. And that's very different to traditional hereditary elites.
A lot of those people, their political embodiment is the Democratic Party of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton as well. That's not looking too politically powerful these days. They seem to be slipping.
They do. I think the jury is out on the way the Democratic Party goes. And, you know, we only really get the answer when we get a nominee, right? You know, that nominee could be somebody on the Bernie Sanders wing or Elizabeth Warren kind of figure, or somebody more malleable like Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, I'd sort of put in that latter category. It could be somebody we haven't thought of. It could be Oprah Winfrey. Or it could be some more conventional Clintonite figure. It's very hard right now to say what the answer to that question is until we see what the Democratic base does. But it isn't going too well. I think Barack Obama is keeping his powder dry. I believe there is an agreement between him and George W. Bush to intervene together jointly if they believe that the American Constitution is actually endangered under Donald Trump. So Obama is confining his statements and activities largely to his own library and his own foundation, both of which epitomize really meritocratic values, the fundraising, the philanthropy, the very carefully arranged diversity, the element of self-congratulation, all of which is, I could not think of a better exemplar than Barack Obama, but which is nevertheless a value system that clashes quite directly with many Americans right now.
The title of the column, which may not be yours, given the way these things work, is The Discreet Terror of the American Bourgeoisie. But are they afraid? I mean, I read the New York Times every day of turmoil in the Trump administration, unfilled positions, all kinds of foolishness, paralysis. But they are doing things. The tax bill people thought wouldn't pass did pass. ICE is rounding up immigrants and deporting them. Are the elites sort of self-medicating with these stories of the incompetence of Trump and his circle?
To some degree, yes. I mean, as you point out, there is a very strong objective reality to that diagnosis of the Trump administration. But he is managing to push things through. He will probably be on the ballot in 2020. This notion that Robert Mueller and the special counsel's investigation will lead to a sort of Scooby-Doo ending in which, you know, we pull his mask off and he admits finally he's a Russian stooge is, I think, you know, present in a lot of liberal fantasies, and I think the odds are against that happening. And so there is an element of self-medication here. There's, I think, an endless sort of bottomless pit of Trumpian ability to outrage people, because he is a profoundly outrageous, repugnant human being. But I think what people who live in the cities, I hate to use the word liberal because it sounds like I hate liberals, I don't, I would probably be defined as one, but the people who move in the kinds of circles I move in think it is self-evident that Trump is unfit for the job, probably corrupt, almost certainly in collusion with a foreign autocrat, that these self-evident truths come across either as wrong or as tedious moralizing distractions from people whose comeuppance has been a long time in coming. And that would describe, a third of America, maybe 40% of America. I guess what's disturbing is we see completely different things. And what I would urge the Democratic Party, and indeed Republican Never Trumpers, to do is think about it from other people's perspective. Get out of the proverbial beltway or the Tribecas or the Aspens or, the Palisades, wherever you live, and talk to people. And you will find that there are plenty who are not deplorable. There are plenty who are not stupid. There are plenty who know full well what Trump is, but they still prefer him. They have such contempt and cynicism about normal establishment politics that they say, look, even Trump is better than you. It's a kind of very calculated, very jugular sort of lunge at politics as normal. And I don't think it's as stupid as we think it is. I think it might be deeply wrongheaded, reckless, counterproductive to America's national interest, all these things. But it's not stupid or racist by definition.
You can read these acts, Brexit, also, or people voting for Trump, as a form of self-expression by resentful, marginalized people who don't really have a whole lot of other modes of expression, right? So they have no political voice anywhere. So this middle finger they extend to the system is all they've got.
In the case of Brexit, it was a quite unnecessary opportunity. There was no need to hold that referendum. And if you're somebody like David Cameron, and you're asking a question to which you don't know the answer, then you get everything you deserve. Unfortunately, the rest of his country are having to suffer the consequence rather than him. Another sort of very good defining characteristic of the modern elites is that you pay no price for your mistakes. Now, David Cameron is, of course, a combination of both the old-fashioned elite and the modern meritocratic one. So he combines, in a way, the worst of both. But there is this quite legitimate feeling that the experts, inverted commas, who were widely mocked by the Trump campaign and by the Brexit pro-Brexit referendum campaign, that the experts got the Iraq war wrong. They got the efficient market hypothesis in the lead up to the 2008 meltdown completely wrong. They got the election wrong, for that matter. They were convinced Trump couldn't win, and that the experts, the technocratic mindset, it isn't quite so justified in its self-belief if you look at the evidence. And they have a point. They have a point. There is a certainty to technocratic consensus that is very resistant to being challenged. There's a deep culture of groupthink amongst elites, just as deep as there is amongst, the most hidebound corner of Appalachia or the Mississippi Delta the slums of the north of England. There is a schadenfreude in delivering electorally a rebuke to these elites. There is something that Trump understands very well, which is there is a pleasure people get in causing discomfort, moral outrage, and indignity to the elites. As you point out, the electorates have used this, sort of significant minorities and in some cases majorities.
During the campaign, Trump promised that he wasn't going to cut Social Security or Medicare. He promised he was going to bring the factory jobs back. Yet now that he's in office, it looks like a lot of his government is a much more conventionally conservative Republican one. Like all those populist traces have been sidelined, except maybe for the anti-immigrant stuff. What do you anticipate? What kind of reaction is going to come from the people who thought that he was going to come up with something different from what they were experiencing?
I don't think that the expectations were as high as we might think they were. You're quite right. Trump ran as a national greatness Republican rather than a libertarian Republican, in which public spending on the middle classes and protecting entitlements was going to be was what differentiated him from the others. And he's governing like a libertarian wet dream. I mean, the Koch brothers really couldn't be happier. Or indeed more surprised. But you're asking whether his electorate are, whether his base is. And I'm not so sure, again, whether they're that disappointed. I think, you know, as the famous phrase went during the 2016 campaign, they took him seriously, but not literally. Whereas the media tended to take him literally, but not seriously. There are a couple of things here worth pointing out. One is, by now, the well-known phrase, negative partisanship, whereby you belong to a party not because you like it or believe in its program. You're way too cynical to believe in anybody's program. You like it because you hate the other party so much. And Trump is fulfilling that promise. He is delivering on that hatred. So in that sense, he is what they want. The second point, though, is more disturbing. Since, as you say, there's nothing there for middle-aged white men who are now obsolete. There's no worker training programs. There's no investment in their infrastructure. There's no promise to protect their social security. There's no opioid program of any seriousness. Since there's none of that, what is it that Trump intends to do? And I think we've got, you know, we've already got 13 months of experience of this, but we've now had hints of a lot more, which is there's going to be more of a cultural emphasis in his politics. There's going to be more of the NFL kneeling kind of controversy. There's going to be more of the kinds of things that Trump is a kind of diabolical genius at, of inflaming group differences, inciting racial resentments, inciting perhaps gender backlash against the Me Too movement, and all the kinds of things that bring out the more visceral side of voters against their more thoughtful side. And so I suspect the result is bad news. We've got bread and circuses, but without much bread.
I'm speaking with the Financial Times columnist Edward Luce. Internationally, Trump has been undermining many of the pillars of the post-World War II American-led order. The trade regime, the NATO, you know, all the defense arrangements. He's just knocking them down one by one. What's this going to do to the world?
You have here in this town, I'm based in Washington, D.C., at least you had until quite recently, a fairly complacent assumption that Trump was an aberration, and that after 4 years of Trump, or less hopefully, we would sort of set back to the status quo ante and America would resume its traditional role of upholding Pax Americana. And I think it's been interesting to see in the last 2 or 3 months, people beginning to shift away from that rather optimistic reading of Trump as a brief aberration, because they see a couple of things happening. One of which is the world is moving on. Whoever succeeds Trump in 2020, if it isn't Trump, is going to find quite a different world to the one that Barack Obama left in 2016, firstly. Secondly, the world had already been changing quite a lot under Barack Obama and indeed George W. Bush. If you look at the share of the world economy China had in the year 2000 and the share of the world economy it has now, it's tripled. And America's has remained roughly the same. So we are going from a world where China was about a fifth the size of the US economy to China's now about 75% to 80% the size of the US economy. And by the end of Trump's term, it'll probably have drawn even. So that's happening, and it has been happening. But I think the third point is that other countries, including Canada, some of the most loyal allies, but Germany, being another example, Australia a third, and then the smaller allies all over the world like Singapore, Gulf allies like Qatar. Other countries are now taking out insurance against America not coming back. And those kinds of steps, that kind of strategic hedging that we're seeing around the world is being exploited by a very ebullient, self-confident China under Xi Jinping, which is unafraid to spend money on soft diplomacy, hard infrastructure, and indeed on hard military force projection. The world we're going to see in 2020 is already going to be a very different one to what Obama bequeaths, quite without mentioning all the errors and indeed deliberate actions Trump will take in between now and then.
In your book, you cite a Gallup poll from 2015 showing fewer Americans identifying as middle class and more identifying as working and lower class. The latest reading of that poll from about a year ago showed a return to the old numbers, that more people are back in the middle class category and fewer in the lower and working class category. Is a 4% unemployment rate taking some of the edge off populist rage, or is this something more deeply structural?
It might be. I mean, I think what's interesting about these self-identification polls is how partisan they are. So if you look in the last year about confidence in the U.S. economy, it's gone down amongst Democrats and it's surged amongst self-identified Republicans. Now, part of this is because we get our news from different places, that people filter, very biased sources that tend to confirm their biases. I think that's, a measure of how partisan we've become. I think part of it, though, is that, for want of a better term, middle-class whites who might have in the previous poll defined themselves as having fallen into the lower class now believe they've moved back into the middle class because they have a champion in the White House. And so there is, unfortunately, some implicit racism in some of these numbers, because it is about people's status and what they believe their status is in society. Does it mean the economy is getting better? Sure. Unemployment, has continued to fall and is now at a near historic low. The labor market participation rate hasn't risen by nearly as much as unemployment has fallen, though. So we've still got a lot of people who dropped out of the labor market who haven't re-entered, and in many cases never will again. If we could turn that into a one-off, a loss of, a certain category of mainly men between the ages of, 40 and 64, then the problem could recede and we could see a gradual return to more confidence and less populism. But I would sort of caution two things there. One is Trump's competence in managing the economy. And I think the tax bill I'd kind of rest my case. I don't need to remind you of its contents. And two, his ability to inflame the kinds of things that lead to populism, even if there's some degree of economic satisfaction.
To turn to the Lenin question, what is to be done? You portray a large chunk of the American masses as feeling surveilled, controlled, underpaid, overworked, and fundamentally disrespected. Doing anything about that would require, in the current political environment, something approaching a revolution. Are we capable of even imagining that, much less doing it?
It's hard to say with much confidence that you can see that coming. But, nobody saw the Berlin Wall falling or Barack Obama being elected or Trump being elected. If you argue objectively that the middle class need a Marshall Plan, regardless of what color and gender and what region of the country they're living in, that they need a massive public and private investment in their skills and in upgrading the federal system to have, benefits, both health and pension and other kinds of benefit for a portable world, for a gig economy. I think that, on its face, this is a no-brainer. Now, working out, the fiscals might be, require the art of political compromise. But I think on paper, we're not lacking in ideas as to what you need to do to help the vast bulk of the American labor force cope with the rapidly changing world we're moving into. What's lacking, as your question implies, any kind of political consensus that you can imagine carrying out some of these plans. And that's what disturbs me, that what was it that Hegel said, nothing straight was made out of the crooked timber of humanity. We're looking really crooked at the moment.
Yes, in every sense. Your book from, I believe, 2012 took its title from a statement by a British lord, was it, who said that we're out of money, so it's time to start thinking. Time to start thinking of the title of the book. We don't seem to have done much thinking in the past 6 years since that book came out, have we?
No, we've kind of rushed into an orgy of thoughtlessness. That book looked at the sort of polarization of the American economy, the bifurcation of the American economy, and its sort of related polarization in politics, and tried to explain why the American system was therefore unable to respond. And I'd say that, you know, it's a great deal worse now. Then, you know, the great fear was gridlock, which of course had become normal in Obama's the second half of his first term, and then again in his for the duration of his second term. A measure of how much worse things have got is now we're actually looking back rather nostalgically on gridlock, because we'd rather Trump didn't do anything. I don't think he's going to permit a sensible compromise on immigration reform. He's certainly not going to look at an intelligent infrastructure bill. These are the sort of two games in town at the moment. So the tax giveaway that his infrastructure proposal is basically all about, it is not something we would like to see on the statute books. This would not actually engender proper public interest infrastructure investments. And what he wants to achieve on immigration, which is to halve legal immigration and essentially penalize the illegals, is definitely something that we don't want to see on the statute book. So gridlock is actually, relatively speaking, the least bad option right now. And yes, I think that is a measure of how thoughtless politics has become. Somebody, I think, once said partisanship makes you stupid. And I think, you know, there's a case to be made. There's a case to be made there. The American system requires people to, you know, work together case by case and find whatever intelligent middle ground there might be and all the trade-offs that are entailed. You think of Everett Dirksen, you think of some of the Republicans in the 60s who enabled civil rights reform, Voting Rights Act, etc. That's just hard to imagine right now, and that is a measure of unthinkingness.
Finally, the opposition party, the Democrats, seem, as you put it earlier, seem to be able to focus on Trump only as, you know, the Putin stooge. They really don't have much of a political critique. They focus on his personality and the circus around him, but they really seem to be a vacuum of ideas in that party.
They do. I mean, if start with foreign policy, I mean, there isn't one. Russia is not a foreign policy. It's an extension of the domestic debate of the hopes invested in Robert Mueller's investigation. But beyond that, there is no democratic foreign policy. It's not like we're having a reinvention of Trumanite values here. It's not like we're having any animated discussion in liberal circles about America's role in this very different world. We've simply got Russia, and that, as I say, is a domestic issue. There is an unsettled debate inside the Democratic Party about why Hillary Clinton lost the 2016 election. And I think large chunks of the party believe that it was because of racism and misogyny, homophobia, etc. And basically that's all we should focus on. And that therefore eventually the demographic majority sort of narrative will win. And I think there's another portion of the party that stresses the economic anxieties of the middle. And it's a rather pointless debate because it's clearly both. You know, it's neither exclusively economic nor exclusively cultural. The two interact, and there was a chemical interaction, and it produced Donald Trump. The point is not to provide a mirror image of Trump by saying, everybody you hate, we will love, and we count out all those people who support you. I think the point is to transcend that and to build a program that appeals to all Americans. And of course, you know, to find a candidate who is able to really enthuse people and build the party around that broader message. And I don't rule that out. You know, we are early days in the 2020 sweepstakes. And I don't rule that out. There are a lot of very, very thoughtful, worried Democrats, anti-Trumpians, liberals, whatever you call them, who are much more open to persuasion, much less it's sort of in cloistered than they might have been a few months ago. So it's a fast-changing picture, and I will therefore uncharacteristically end on an optimistic note and say we could see a very good candidate for 2020 beating Trump comprehensively. And I have to sort of emphasize, I feel this is quite important, that Trump must be beaten by the people, not by the courts, not by an impeachment process. He has to be repudiated by the electorate. That is the path of light. That is the way out of this.
I'm going to see if I can borrow some of that optimism. Maybe it will even last through the day. That was Edward Luce, who writes a column for the Financial Times. A minor correction, it was Kant, not Hegel, who said, out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made. And another, it was not an English lord, but a knighted Nobel Prize-winning physicist, Sir Ernest Rutherford, who said, gentlemen, we have run out of money. It is time to start thinking. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a 1980 song from Iggy Pop, Take Care of Me, that, with a few adjustments, could describe the situation of the USA today. Till next week, bye.